You know, it's interesting because contraception, just contraception, so not even talking about the other reproductive healthcare areas of, you know, oncology and well women's health and maternal health, just contraception is a $19 billion global category. So it's a very large market, and what people don't recognize too, because there's not a lot of deal flow in the space. You don't hear about women's reproductive health a lot. It's not a focus of venture capitalists. And as I mentioned, it's not a focus, it's a commercial focus, thus the $19 billion category for pharmaceutical companies globally, but it's not an R&D focus, so you don't hear about it a lot.
Welcome to Startup Talk with Millard and Andrew. Millard Chan and Andrew Moss launched this podcast to give a voice to the countless founders, angel investors, incubators, supporters, and startup events located in San Diego.
Welcome back to another episode of Startup Talk with Millard and Andrew. I'm Millard. Andrew, how you doing, man?
I am not bad. We are here still in Little Italy at the Desk Hub facility, and we are having a great time today.
Yeah, we are about, I don't know, 4 blocks away from the ocean, man.
Yeah, and we've got just views of construction happening. You know, it's hustle bustle down here.
Absolutely. Beautiful tree. I don't know what type of tree that is, but beautiful purple flowers.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I'm not, unfortunately, not an expert in the botanical area. But today we have a great guest on with us. It's Sabrina Martucci-Johnson. She is a life science executive with a record of achievement in capital formation, business development, and commercial leadership. Sabrina's unique background spans finance, global marketing, product development, and bench research. Sabrina is committed to advancing innovations in women's health. In 2015, she founded Daré Bioscience to bring novel technologies that clearly address unmet needs to the clinic so that the latest concepts in women's health can make it to the market. Sabrina, how are you doing?
Great, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes, you have quite the impressive resume. Tell us a little bit about your previous job experience that led you to founding Daré Bioscience.
Yeah, absolutely. So I spent really my whole career in pretty much traditional life science, most of it here in San Diego. Started in research, working in a lab, and realized pretty quickly I wanted to be on the business side, not the research side, but wanted to stay in that biotech industry. And then really moved up the ranks, as is indicated, through research, marketing, sales, and eventually CFO, COO of a publicly traded company. And when we sold that company, I decided I wanted to do something totally different. I had never worked in women's health. I always envisioned that I would at some point in my career, and really also wanted to work in global health. Had my business degree is from an international MBA program, Thunderbird. And so I thought, you know, I really want to get out there and work in Africa and Asia and Latin America. So I joined a global nonprofit. And it's really a specialty pharma. We launch products around the world, and we were technically a nonprofit because we worked in developing countries. But we focused on reproductive health. And to your question of what led me to form Daré, I discovered that there was so much innovation happening, but it wasn't happening where we expect it to happen and where we typically see it. It was a lot of donor money coming in from the Gates Foundation, Buffett Foundation, governments around the world that were investing in developing new reproductive healthcare products, both family planning as well as maternal health. And there was kind of pharma on the back end that was willing to take products that were later stage in development and take them forward globally. But there was this gap in the middle. And I was seeing a lot of really incredible innovation and new products that could absolutely address unmet needs, both from private developers and from nonprofit developers, but no one was filling that gap in the middle. And so I decided to go back and do what I do best and really take that background that I have in life sciences through research, development, sales and marketing, capital formation, put it together and form Daré so that we could really take those products forward and fill that gap.
Oh, that's great. I mean, yeah, the story is, it's really amazing how you kind of got to where you are now, that's
right,
for sure. And can you tell us about some of the products you currently have on the market or that are in the pipeline at Daré?
Yeah, so we have our lead product is still development stage. It's been through a human study, and it's a contraceptive. And while there are a lot of different contraceptive products on the market, the vast majority are hormonal. And there really aren't great options for women who are looking for a non-hormonal choice, but don't want something they have to use in the moment. So our product, Ovaprene, is a product that works for weeks, So basically 1 month at a time. And so a woman doesn't have to think about it. There's no action that has to be taken. So it's a short acting method, meaning it's not an implant that a physician has to put in or remove. It's something that the woman initiates herself. It's most analogous to like a diaphragm plus spermicide, except it works over several weeks, except in different than just working once. And so it really gives a woman a choice of something that she doesn't have to think about and doesn't have to take action in the moment, but gives her effectiveness, hopefully, comparable to hormonal methods. So the product's been through one clinical study, and we're getting ready to take it back into the market.
So going back to the earlier days, as you going through the, say, the customer discovery and customer validation portion of developing the product, what was the feedback from the customers about those hormonal contraceptive methods?
Yeah, a lot of women can't tolerate hormones. And so there's a whole segment of the population that is truly contraindicated, meaning they can't take them for health reasons. So high blood pressure, you know, high BMI, typically women at cardiovascular risk. So there's a whole segment of the market where they aren't even allowed to take them if they wanted to. And then there's another segment of the market that have tried, because if you go to your physician and you ask for a contraceptive, a hormonal method is likely the first thing that's going to be offered to you. Since the 1960s, when the first contraceptive pill was developed, that's really where the focus of product development and innovation has happened. And so if you go to your physician, that's likely the first thing you're going to be given. And for many women, it's a side effect profile that they can't tolerate. A lot of them are nuisance side effects, but to the extent where a woman will simply stop taking the method. And therefore in a position where she's not using an effective contraceptive method.
And what portion of the population is that, percentage-wise, that can't handle it or have the too high BMI or, you know,
You know, there are different figures out there, some as high as 15% of the population, some lower. If you look at the mix of what women are choosing today, which is a really good sense of giving you as to what where they kind of fall within that spectrum, about half of the population is choosing some sort of longer-acting method or sterilization. So they've either decided that I want an implant, I want something that's good for 3 to 10 years, or I'm done. So either me or my partner is going to go for sterilization. And then if you look at the other half of the market that's selecting short-acting methods, that's a good way to kind of look at your question. About 28% are on hormones. And then there's about 10 to 15% that are on some sort of non-hormonal method, but that is truly a method that they'd be using, like a condom or a diaphragm. And then there's the rest of them are basically using like withdrawal or a method that's not considered a true contraceptive technology.
So going back to what you said before, Sabrina, that's almost classically a market ripe for disruption, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a large challenge, which is birth control. There are products on the market, hormonal products. People eventually stop using them. And so that's a huge gap left to be filled.
That's absolutely right. And if you talk to women, kind of to your question earlier too, about what do they want, what are they looking for? So about 67% of women will say that a monthly option is ideal for them and that a monthly vaginal ring has the features that they're looking for, which is convenience, ease of use, but still short acting so that it's quickly reversible. Meaning if I'm spacing children and I decide that now it's time, you know, again, where I want to reverse that contraception, it's very easy to do so. And women who are looking for something short acting, that's very key to them. They want efficacy, of course. Efficacy is sort of your cost of entry. The method has to work. But as long as you have a method that works, then they're looking for convenience. And in that short-acting segment, where they're not looking for something implanted, they want it to quickly reverse.
Actually, just a little bit more technical on the regulatory side. Has Daré considered to launch first in Europe before the States? Because from what I understand from back in my genomics days, in Europe, to get the CE-IVD mark, you have to prove just safety, whereas for the FDA in the States, you have to prove safety and efficacy.
That is a great question, and you're absolutely right. So the regulatory pathway in Europe is quicker than in the United States for a method like this. With contraception, you do still need to show effectiveness, but it's not at the same numbers of subjects as the FDA requires. And so both the FDA have determined that this would be regulated as a medical device as opposed to a drug, that agency will lead the review. And the same is true in Europe, where it would be a CE mark. Just the number of subjects that we'll need for the U.S. is more. So the strategy and plan is that we should be able to file in Europe, to your question, before we can actually file in the United States.
I've got a broader question, and so I'm coming from the point of view of a guy, so I don't know. Are women's health products, how are women's health products viewed from, say, mind share and wallet share compared to the whole health field?
You know, it's interesting because contraception, just contraception, so not even talking about the other reproductive healthcare areas of, you know, oncology and well women's health and maternal health, just contraception is a $19 billion global category.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a very large market. And what people don't recognize too, because there's not a lot of deal flow in the space, you don't hear about women's reproductive health a lot. It's not a focus of venture capitalists. And as I mentioned, it's not a focus, it's a commercial focus, thus the $19 billion category for pharmaceutical companies globally, but it's not an R&D focus, so you don't hear about it a lot.
Why? Do you have any kind of like guesses as to why?
You know, it's really unclear why that happened and how that came to be. I think it is in part due to the fact that there's been such a donor commitment to the space. So some of the biggest contraceptive brands today, so sometimes, taking a step back, sometimes donors will stop funding at sort of phase one or phase two. They feel like they've proven the concept and now someone else should step in. But sometimes they'll take a product all the way through to NDA, to FDA approval. So if you look at Bayer and their product Mirena, which is a hormonal implant, that's over a $1 billion product. That product was developed by a nonprofit developer. It was funded all the way through to NDA with donor money. So I think in part it's an artifact of, in some cases, these donors are willing to step in. And that includes the NIH and, you know, it's not just foundations.
Do you think it's because birth control may be perceived as a third world problem to control their populations and therefore it's kind of donor financed?
That's definitely a part of it. And so using Bayer's Mirena as an example, that was developed for the developing world. That was the target for that product. It turns out it has an absolutely excellent profile for women around the world, you know, in developed countries as well. So I think you've definitely hit on it. And that's why we've become reliant on this donor flow of funding. About 90% of the funding that's going into early innovation is coming from the donor community. And again, that includes both governments as well as foundations like Gates and Susan Buffett's foundation.
Yeah, I didn't realize that it was such a big chunk of the money. Wow, that is surprising to me.
It is, and that's part of what creates, you know, unfortunately, a gap, right, to what we've been talking about, but that's also what creates an opportunity for an organization like Daré to step in and fill that. We don't have to, we can really be capital efficient in how we use the money we raise. We don't need to invest in that early innovation. That's happening, and it's happening really well. And we don't need to invest in building out a robust commercial pipeline and capabilities because that's already out there as well. What we need to do is focus our resources on taking those products to the next level where industry can step in, big pharmaceutical, and help make the access possible.
So is the commercial roadmap focused on developing countries or developed countries?
The beauty is, I mean, we're focusing primarily on developed countries, okay. So focusing on the U.S. and Europe. But the flip of that is once you get a product approved in the U.S. and Europe, once you have that stringent regulatory approval, you can register it pretty much everywhere else around the world. So it, you know, by us focusing on these markets and also where the volumes are greater and the scale is going to be greater, and therefore you're also driving down your cost of goods, you're, you know, making the economics a lot more favorable. With those approvals, you can get it into all these other countries. And there are great distribution networks already set up, particularly for reproductive health, you know, around the world to make sure that then women have access to the products.
Going back to access to funds, and apologize if I'm pressing hot buttons out there, do you think it matters if there is any, say, female representation at the venture capital funds, whether that would affect directing the flow of their investments?
It definitely is a hot topic. You know, it does make a difference. And certainly for us, when we're talking about, you know, contraception and family planning and women's reproductive health, it absolutely is meaningful to have someone on the other side of the table, right, when you're talking to a funder who understands that landscape, has had their own experiences with it. Even understands things as simple as what typical contraceptive effectiveness are. I mean, we find ourselves educating people around the fact that hormones, short-acting hormones, are only 91% effective. People think they're 100%. Diaphragms are 88%. That's actually great. They're right in the range, but most people don't understand that. So, you know, it's laying that foundation so that then you can take the next step and understand that a non-hormonal method that is convenient has convenience beyond that of diaphragms, which are inconvenient, but is convenient and monthly. And if it has that same level of effectiveness, it's right there in the same level as hormones. So, you know, you really have to start like before square one when you're dealing with people that from an investment perspective haven't seen the space before, but also from a personal perspective haven't been the one making those decisions.
So the lead product's name, is it NuvaRing?
So Ovaprene is our product.
Sorry.
And NuvaRing, no, is a great analogy that we point to. So NuvaRing is basically the hormonal version.
Got it.
Of Ovaprene. It's a Merck product of $777 million in sales. That was the 2016 number.
It's large.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you had mentioned effectiveness of diaphragms, 88%. Of hormonal methods, 91%. So what's the effectiveness of the...
Of Ovaprene?
Ovaprene.
Yeah, so it's been through one human study. It's called the postcoital test study. It's basically when you evaluate a couple after they've had intercourse, and you're looking to see whether live sperm basically can survive in the cervical mucus. It's a great proxy for contraceptive effectiveness, mm-hmm. and it's typically for any barrier method, that first study that you do. And from other studies that we can look at, and particularly three other studies we can look at with other products that have gone on to do contraceptive effectiveness studies that tell you the percentage of actual pregnancy protection you're going to get, we've seen that all those products that have had zero motile sperm in the cervical mucus go on to show 88% effectiveness in their clinical pivotal studies. So Ovaprene in the study that's been conducted to date has shown that same level,
okay.
Zero sperm in the cervical mucus. And so if we extrapolate those findings, that's the range we would expect to be in, assuming we perform like those other products.
Okay. So in other words, similar in effectiveness, without a large number of those side effects.
Exactly. And with the convenience.
Got it.
Switching lanes just a little bit, can you elaborate on particular challenges women in STEM face, whether in school or in the workplace?
Yeah, you know, it's changed a lot over the course of my career. I feel there's a lot more opportunities today. But having said that, it still is a challenge for women sometimes to be heard in those roles. And as importantly, and particularly as you're going through the education process, to understand what your opportunities are. We have a very sort of myopic view as you're going through education as to what STEM jobs are. And sometimes women in particular who may be better communicators sometimes than their male counterparts, or maybe don't want to, like me, be the one literally in the laboratory doing the work every day, but want to be able to be in this field. Sometimes there's not that awareness of the breadth of career choices that exist in STEM. And so I think for women, that's one of the remaining challenges. And then also to just give them the opportunities, you know, to speak up in class, to be heard, you know, they're not as likely, you know, all that data that we hear as their male counterparts, to participate in that way. And so continuing to encourage them to do that and give them those opportunities.
Yeah, you were mentioning just before we started our podcast about your daughter, and I was shocked that it's still happening in schools that, you know, the professors still aren't giving them women the credit that they deserve.
Yeah, I mean, and it's unfortunate that it's seen still, you know, in the education system where, you know, in her case, her and her lab partner were kind of really the leaders in the class, and the guys that are at the bench next to them kind of get credit for the work that they have done when the teacher goes around and, you know, is critiquing people's work. So I think, and it's going to take young women like my daughter, who in this case was willing to speak up and talk to the professor about what was happening and, you know, making sure that her contributions to the class were seen. But not all kids are going to feel comfortable doing that.
Sure, yeah.
Right?
You absolutely have to, because you just can't assume that your brilliant work is going to be observed and or recognized and highlighted by those around you.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And, you know, in part by forming Daria, I have two teenage daughters. I mean, part of it too is for them to see what women can do, right? Like, this is an idea I had. You can go out, you can do it, you can make it happen, you can get funded, you can, you know, follow your dream, do whatever it is you want to do.
Absolutely. It's a great life lesson. Yeah, sure. And you spend a lot of time in the community volunteering at nonprofits. Can you kind of give us an idea of what you do with them and what resources they provide?
Yeah. So kind of going back to my daughters, I mentioned I have two teenage girls. And in 2011, I had kind of this wake-up call. My girls were 11 and 14 at the time, that I was a super hard worker. I was showing a great role model. I was a public company CFO and COO and very successful. But I wasn't showing them someone who gave back in the community. And I felt that was important to show that balance, right? You have to work hard, but you also have a responsibility as someone who has achieved a certain level of success to be a role model to others in the community. And so I decided to really focus on organizations that help women in STEM and create opportunities for women in STEM, and then in general really support women to become economically self-sufficient. And so I volunteer with Athena, and I know we're familiar with Athena and what they do in the community for professional women in STEM, but also organizations.
Oh, so let me just interject over there. Congratulations on your Pinnacle Award from last
week. Right. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Could you tell a little bit about that? Because it's so recent and it's such a great achievement. So we'd love to hear a few words.
Yeah, definitely. So it's such an honor. So I won the individual in life science in that category. And it's really for an individual who has obviously is working in the life science industry, has been a leader in her field, but also to the question is kind of also giving back in the community and helping other women advance. And so, you know, I'm not a judge, so I'm not sure why they selected me. I'm thrilled that they did, but I think it's in part due to a lot of what I've done, like with Athena, is I've participated actively in mentoring programs. So that's a very important, for me, component of my volunteering, whether it's other women in STEM or whether in the case of Athena and work that I did with them or whether it's with some of these other groups, you know, to the early question that I volunteer with, it's really around providing a role model and, you know, a roadmap for people of what can be possible and helping women navigate, you know, in the workplace. How do you move ahead?
So I'm pretty sure that you mentor men as well as women.
I do.
And so do you, taking a step back, do you see the typical questions that the man asks as different than a woman would ask?
Yes.
In terms of career advice and guidance?
Yeah, very different. So women tend to be focused on more worried about how they interact in the workplace and how they can be recognized and noticed and what they need to do to get ahead, like very process-oriented and assuming there are sort of steps in that. And whereas the men, it's more an assumption that I'm going to move ahead. I want to make sure I'm doing all the right things. Have I missed anything? Right? So it's a very different mindset. And when I'm mentoring men too,
in other words, there's a checklist. They know what's on the checklist. They just want to make sure they're checking off all the boxes. Whereas the women are actually asking what are the questions on that checklist.
Exactly. And what is the checklist? And there's also a difference in my approach too, because when I'm working with women, it's around helping them see, one, they can still be themselves in the workplace, right? We don't have to be someone different. We can achieve, you know, utilizing our strengths of our own personality as opposed to trying to be someone else. And with men, sometimes I'm trying to get them to focus on being better listeners, paying attention to other cues in the workplace that maybe they're missing. So it's the focus tends to be a little bit different as well.
So you've been in the startup community for a little while now. What tips do you have for other entrepreneurs that are kind of starting out?
Network. Can't stress that enough. There are so many great resources in this community, and we have so many organizations that are there to help out if only they know you need it. So I was sharing earlier before we started. So we are in BioLabs space. It's a great incubator space for an organization that doesn't have maybe the financial wherewithal to pay for a big lease. And we don't need lab space in our case, but we needed space for conference rooms and meetings. Law firms, like we work with Mintz Levin and negotiated a package with them, a startup package to help us get started. And, you know, when we didn't have a lot of funding. On the financial side, we work with strategic analytics and really work with them on filling in the gaps in our finance team. So there are a lot of, I say network because there are a lot of great resources out there and people often aren't aware of what they are, and there are opportunities to keep your capital costs way down, but at the same time achieve your objectives. And then there's organizations like Athena that just provide great support to the women's who are members, but are also great connectors in the communities and know themselves. So, I have our men's relationship is through Athena, and, so there are some great opportunities there.
It all connects, yeah.
It all connects. And so I always encourage people, and tell the world what you want to do. You would be amazed at how one conversation can lead to another that can lead to money. So it's important.
Speaking of which, for your personal and professional life, what additional help are you looking for from people, companies, or organizations?
Yeah, I would say at this point, we're really looking to get our message out there a little bit more. So we've been fortunate in that we signed a transaction a little over a month ago that has to go to shareholder vote. But if everything closes, we will become public, Daré Bioscience. So it's a reverse merger transaction.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
So that does solve the visibility issue. You'll have broader visibility.
We will, and we really want to make sure we're kind of prepared for that. So, how to get, we don't tweet. how to get kind of our message out there, and we're to a phase where we want to start reaching that broader community and women, getting ready to start up a clinical trial. It's important that people are aware of, what the product is and the opportunity to participate in studies. So we're at kind of a different phase and looking for support in that.
Right. So as we wrap up, Sabrina, how can people reach out to you?
So our website is a great way, and there's a link on the website to contact us directly. So it's www.darebioscience.com. So that's really the best way. As I said, we're not on social media yet, but that's our next big foray when we'll be there.
Excellent. So if you want to find us, you can tweet us at Startup Talk Pod. Tweet me personally at Millard Y. Chan. Send us an email, startuptalkpodcast@gmail.com, or check out our website at startuptalkpodcast.com. Well, that concludes another episode of Startup Talk with Millard and Andrew. Sabrina, thank you so much for spending time and sharing your story.
Oh my gosh, thank you both.
Yeah, it was great. Let's get started.
Hey folks, please subscribe to Startup Talk with Millard and Andrew on iTunes and rate and review us. It helps other people find this podcast. This episode was produced by Millard Chan and Andrew Moss. Our sound editor is Lee Liang. Additional voices from Mindy Nguyen. Our theme music is Good Times by Poddington Bear from soundofpicture.com. Our podcast Sherpa is Charles Wilchett.